Welcome to part two of our dive into the submarine career of Commander Rob Forsyth. And in this one, we start with a rather exciting and dangerous crash dive in a Polaris submarine trying to avoid a Soviet vessel. And then get an inside perspective on the famous Perisher course, which is used by the Royal Navy to select submarine captains. Also, Rob tells us about his time in command of the hunter-killer submarine HMS Scepter and how he went in pursuit of a Soviet Navy carrier in the Mediterranean. But having explored the daily life of a Polaris submarine, a deterrent submarine, there was a moment of excitement where actually you had to crash dive the Polaris submarine.
Yeah, that happened under circumstances where I had to be in command temporarily, because going off on patrol on one occasion, my captain had an extremely bad back. He had a back weakness, and he couldn't move, and he was flat on his back in his cabin, and the decision was made to sail on patrol as planned, and I would be in temporary command for the passage out and diving, and hand it back to the captain when he felt capable of physically taking command back. And he was a fairly straightforward captain. And I said to him, "So how are we going to play this? Do I come and keep you in the picture?" He said, no, either you're in command or not. He said, "You do exactly what you think is correct as commanding officer. And if you have time afterwards, brief me as to what's happened. But don't keep dashing in and asking me what you should do. You're in command," which seemed quite straightforward. So coming out through the North Channel past Norton Island and Rathlin Island, always loitering and waiting for us was a Russian intelligence gathering fishing boat called an AGI, was the NATO terminology, who would always snoop and come and try and gather intelligence on you, and often close quite closely. On this occasion, he just kept on closing and closing and closing until he was parked about 200 yards astern of us, a couple of cables, and he was just trailing after us like a line of battleship,
right?
You're used to in the old days. And I thought, he's so close that actually, if he's still there when we come to dive, we got a problem. And we're not fast enough to outrun him. He could keep up with us, but I couldn't outrun him. So I thought the only thing to do was actually to dive so quickly that he couldn't catch us before we went underwater. Well, they're fairly cumbersome beasts, Polaris submarines, you know, several thousand tons of hull, designed to take 5 to 10 minutes to dive under normal circumstances in a controlled manner, a bit like going down in the lift slowly. Here, we were going to point downwards and go down quickly. So what we did was very quietly allow our ballast tanks, which help you dive, to fill up with water till we were a bit like the Dakar, low in the water, which we had to do systematically so he didn't notice that we were doing it. Took the crew to action stations so that we were fully prepared for any eventuality. Briefed them on what we were going to do over the Tannoy and say that actually we're going to do a World War II crash dive shortly. And bring the officer of the watch down below into the submarine, and when I give the word, we just go for it.
So you have a Russian AGI hot on the tail of the submarine, and what you're saying is that being such a big beast and not able to conclusively outpace this vessel, when you do a normal dive, then obviously the Russian will kind of run into the stern or the aft part of the submarine. Is that what would have happened had you not done the crash dive?
Yes. Well, Robin, I wasn't sure of whether he was choosing this time to actually try and create a collision with us on the surface by perhaps engaging with the rudder, which sticks out of the water at the back end, or what he was doing. But he was extremely close. And when I called him up and said, "Can I help you?" And he replied, "No." And I said, "What do you want?" And he didn't reply.
And that was on radio, was it? Sorry, was that on radio?
No, with the light, flashing light.
All right, sorry, yeah.
And we tried to talk to him. He wasn't going to chat to us, and I didn't know. I couldn't take the risk of diving normally because he could obviously do quite serious damage. and stop the patrol. And at the moment that we wanted to dive, brought the officer off the bridge quietly, and then said, full head together, full dive, effectively, and tipped the boat downwards about 10 or 15 degrees and rang on full speed and went down to a safe depth extremely quickly, far quicker than Polaris boats normally do. And as we did so, I heard the screws of the AGI pass overhead. So he was very close, very close. My command plane.
Yes.
To his credit, the captain stuck to his guns and despite his bad back, left me to it.
Yeah, yeah. And so after that excitement, maybe you did other patrols after that, but after the period in the Polaris submarine, you then went on to be one of the Perisher Course teachers. So how did that happen?
Well, that was a really plum job to be given. I was slightly surprised, but extremely pleased that I'd been chosen, because not many people get to be teacher. I was a bit daunted at first, wondered if I could do the job, because it's quite a responsibility. I got promoted to commander as well at the same time, based on my track record, presumably at Repulse, where my captain had commended me for promotion. But talking to a former teacher, he said, just remember, when you go to sea, after the first attack, you're doing every attack. The students would take it in turns. If you've got six or eight students, you will be eight attacks up and in practice before they are. You'll be much more practiced quite quickly. So he said, you don't need to be nervous. It'll all come to you. And he was quite right.
And as teacher, just to explain this to maybe people that are not quite au fait with it, teacher is the course leader. There are two parallel courses in. You were one of the two teachers, and the teacher is the course leader, the invigilator, the person who decides who passes and who doesn't. Is that right?
Yes, we were given between six, seven, eight students, depending how, twice a year, two teachers. So there were two courses of 6 months, nearly twice a year. And you were everything. You were the training officer, you were the assessment officer, you were really held the future of these chaps totally in your hand. You had to decide whether they were safe to take a submarine to sea, whether they had the right attributes to be a commanding officer, the presence and the knowledge to command, and whether they were skilled enough to carry out the operational functions of whatever submarine they were in, otherwise known as attacking or surveillance or mine laying or periscope reconnaissance, all the various tasks you did. So you were the be-all and the end-all of their future, and a large part of it was a psychological assessment to see, as I had wondered when I did my own Perisher, whether they have the ability to have this spatial awareness, to be not get lost in a box doing what's right in front of them, but be in command of the total situation. And some can, and some can't. The ones who could pass, the ones who couldn't, failed. I have to say, during my time, anybody who failed, and I with about average, probably in the numbers who failed, not one of them ever challenged me that he shouldn't have failed. They all knew that actually they hadn't quite got that something that makes a submarine commanding officer. And not everybody can be or wants to be.
Just to further illustrate the practicalities of it, the teacher and the 6-7 would-be commanding officers, the students, they are lodged within a diesel, at this time, this is the mid-70s, are lodged within a diesel electric submarine, which is basically borrowed to do this course. Is that right?
Yes, each of them takes it in turn to be commanding officer for a period, during which time they conduct an attack which the teacher has set up by talking to his targets, which he's been allocated, which could be anything from 1 to 5 surface ships. who he communicates with separately on his own radio net, and he has his own periscope for safety. But the student effectively is in command during his time being given this particular attack. The actual captain of the submarine has handed the submarine over to teacher and hovers in the background, desperately anxious as to what's going to happen to his submarine. And will his crew be able to support teacher and the trainees correctly? It's quite a complicated relationship.
Yeah, and I should imagine there could be a huge amount of stress for somebody who's a student who's not only got the captain of the submarine there, but you there and the fellow students, but himself at the time, it would all be men, having to carry out this attack with all those people watching. And also knowing, as a submariner, that the captain of a submarine is the person upon whom the crew, you know, 80, 90, 100 people live or die. Hmm. So it must have been incredibly stressful. So I suppose it's one of the most extreme stress tests that anybody can do.
Yes, it is. And if there wasn't any stress, like the student looked at him, he was taking it too calmly. Of course, you then created stress artificially by sort of familiar tricks where to get somebody to shout fire, fire in, say, the engine room, and the firefighting party appear from forward with a hose, and they take the hose round the trainee captain and out of the back of the, down to the engine room. Right. And see how he copes yeah. with that. You have people who artificially start a fight, distraction things, to see whether the captain will put safety first before completing his attack or how he will handle himself. So you could do that.
This person has to have a 3D picture of the exterior and everything else going on during the attack, but also be aware of the interior as well. Is that what you're saying?
Has to be totally aware of the submarine's safety and what his crew are doing and how much the submarine's under control. So he's got a whole pile of things to think of at the same time. And how he prioritizes them and works them out is the clue as to whether he can cope.
And these are torpedo attacks, using practice torpedoes, against warships and Royal Fleet Auxiliary tankers, pretending to be targets.
Yes, yes. It was in those days. It still is. They still do surface attacks. But of course, life has moved on. There's much more anti-submarine work now than there was then. Much more, yes, anti-submarine work. And they do missile firing, cruise missile firing. And so the role of the submarine has grown enormously from where we were in the 70s.
And if you had to fail somebody, what was the routine then? Did you take them to one side to tell them gently they were never going to be a submarine captain?
Yes, well, quite straightforward. Generally, it was apparent. And actually, interestingly, thinking about the crew being aware that these people could be in command of them, of course, the crew were watching them as well. And so the crew were making their own assessments as to who was going to be a commanding officer, which was always interesting. And as teacher, while you didn't rely on what the crew thought, the crew would in their own way make you aware if they thought somebody they were not happy with. And it was a factor. But if, yes, come the time when you decided they weren't going to make it, generally you arrange through circumstances to put them into a situation which they probably couldn't cope with, so they failed themselves and knew it. They knew, in my day, they came into the little cabin, you used the captain's cabin, which used an office where you debriefed him, and you said, I think, whatever it is, I think we've come to an end of a road here, you know, this is not for you. And they would generally say yes, with some relief quite often, because they were under stress and pressure. And the routine was that anticipating this, I, teacher, would have called up a surface ship, because we were always in the Clyde area, not too far from land, and a high-speed boat would be loitering ready, anticipating this. The submarine would surface, the steward would have packed this officer's bags, and he'd be out of the submarine onto the fast boat and heading back to Faz Lane very quickly with a bottle of whiskey to console him on the way back home.
Yeah, and I mean, as a a mere civilian, a landlubber. I cannot think of anything more stressful, really, or awesome as well than being in command of a submarine and with all those people whose lives depend upon you, and also the task you've got to do on behalf of the nation, in which, you know, you can hold the fate of a nation within your hands when being a submarine captain. But the ultimate thing is the nuclear-powered submarine, because that's a whole bigger scale, different scale of command. And you went on from being the teacher and the parachute to command HMS Scepter, the first captain of HMS Scepter, a Swissshore-class nuclear-powered attack submarine. And the first time you saw that boat at Barrow, it was, I think, launch day, and you got quite an impression of the new command that you were about to take
over.
Yes,
she was enormous. I mean, standing on the platform next to Lady White, wife of Admiral White, who was going to launch her with a bottle of Taunton cider, because my first lieutenant executive officer was in the cider business. His father, who had been an admiral, had a cider orchard, and we decided to use cider instead of champagne. And I just remember looking at it and thinking, she's enormous. And when you don't see it underwater, but you certainly see it on the launch slipway, or if you ever go into a dry dock. And I just remember thinking, that's a very big block of flats we got to take to sea there. But she was, what, 6-8 stories high and as long as a block of flats.
Yeah. So you were graduating from on this unique route for yourself from the, you'd been in Polaris submarine, then you were a teacher, now you were graduating to be in command of one of, a dozen or so, actually more than that probably, hunter-killer submarines. And so that was something you felt keenly aware of, that it was you were now moving into the sort of Premier League. Was that something that you felt?
Yeah, I think the combination of being teacher followed by command of an SSN was really as good as it could get in the submarine world. It was sort of peak of both ambition and what you could do operationally. So it was a challenge and a privilege, yeah.
And this was the late 1970s, so...
77.
So without going into every spit and cough of Scepter's story and your story here, I mean, get a book plug in here. It's laid out in the book that I did, Fixtures Yourself and Other People, called Hunter Killers. But the thing that one of the major episodes I think that people would be interested in is you were actually sent to the Mediterranean to try and get a handle on a Russian vessel there, which was a bit like not Hunt Red October, but hunt the Russian surface carrier, or whatever you call it, helicopter carrier.
Moskva.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, she was in the Eastern Mediterranean. We were in Gibraltar, and we were deployed to go and find her, and she was still an object of intelligence curiosity to the west, and we were tasked to go and find her and probably do an underwater look and do eavesdropping and things like that. When we sailed, we were slightly hampered because we had a small defect in the casing which was making a noise, and we had to come back and fix it. And then we sailed and went at speed down to the eastern end of the Mediterranean, and we were quite fast. We were one of the fastest, if not the fastest, of the nuclear submarines at sea at the time. But we were very relying on intelligence, and we were not yet fully equipped with what's called special fit equipment, which intelligence gathering submarines have. So we had a limited amount of communication, but we did have an infrared periscope for seeing at night, which was quite good. But we were very dependent on advance intelligence from the RAF, and there were problems with the communication. And every time we arrived at point X, Moskva had moved to point Y. And after various fruitless chases to try and intercept her, she retired back into the Black Sea, and we'd missed the opportunity actually to gather too much intelligence on her. So it was a weakness of communication, which is critical when you're trying to bring two units together, which was just we hadn't got the right equipment.
And this was getting feed from NATO, RAF, Maritime Patrol aircraft.
Yeah. So we were having to come up the periscope depth from time to time to receive their signals, and there were time lags and communication problems, and it wasn't the best scenario for a joint operation, and we didn't in the end finish up intercepting her.
No, and the two things that occur to me about that, one is that obviously the speed and endurance of a nuclear-powered submarine would enable people to even contemplate in the first place across the Mediterranean to try and find a new Russian type of vessel that NATO wanted intelligence on. And that's the other bit, in that the gold in the Cold War was intelligence on what a vessel looked like, sounded like, etc. So if it ever turned hot, NATO could do something about them and counter them. And that was the business of the Cold War, wasn't it? To find intelligence.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And the nuclear-powered submarine, like Scepter, was the ultimate, provided you had the communication, was the ultimate platform to do that with at sea.
Absolutely. Yeah. It has the endurance, the range, the space to fit the kit, and so yes. It is the ultimate Cold War combatant, really.
Yeah.
And still is, which perhaps is why, which is another subject, Australia is getting into the nuclear submarine business.
Yeah, we could touch on that. I mean, we're nearing the end now of our chat, I think. It's been very, very interesting. But you were actually coming to the conclusion of your own career, weren't you, in the Navy? It was Scepter the last command that you had?
The last sea command, yes. I then went to the Ministry of Defence for 2 years in operational requirements, defining what we call the Type 2400 diesel submarine, which upholder class, which sadly, after coming into service and proving that they were highly capable submarines, we got out of the diesel business, which many of us think is a mistake. And they were sold to Canada.
Yeah, well, they still are today, yeah.
And at that point, I thought I wasn't mad keen on the surface navy, really, and I joined submarines, and I'd done everything I wanted in submarines, and the navy was going to contract. This was before the Falklands. There was quite a lot of talk about halving the size of the navy. And I thought, well, I've done that, tick that box, really enjoyed my operational time as a submariner. And I think it's time for me in life to do something else, possibly see something of my family.
And that was the early 1980s by then. That was just before the...
Yeah, that was 1981. Yeah. So I left the Navy and it went into industry. That's another story.
Yes, that was just before the Falklands War.
Yeah.
A whole different life. So here we are 40 years on from that, but 30 plus years on from the end of the Cold War. As you said, today, the day we talk, there's actually going to be an announcement on Australia moving into the nuclear-powered submarine arena. A triple announcement with Joe Biden, the Australian Prime Minister, and Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, announcing the way ahead with whatever submarine mix they're going to have. That's been a subject of much speculation. And then at the same time in the UK is not only helped the Australians, whichever way it is, in creating a new nuclear-powered submarine flotilla, but also trying to build the Dreadnought-class ballistic missile submarine. So just to have a roundup of maybe looking back on the power and the relevance of submarines, the Australians are getting into the game. The Chinese, the French, the Brazilians are going to have a nuclear-powered submarine. The Indians and, of course, the British, Russians and ourselves. So the nuclear submarine still remains relevant, would you say, as a conventional strategic tool, as it were, for governments? But also, does it still remain relevant as a nuclear deterrent platform?
Well, there's quite a lot of questions wrapped up in that. Are nuclear submarines relevant? I think for the moment they are. The ocean is not yet transparent, but we shouldn't stick our head in the sand. There's, at the same time, there's a lot of work going on to make the oceans less transparent, which would make nuclear submarines less invulnerable. there's a way to go, but I don't think anything is forever. And by the time the Australian submarines and our future SSNR comes into service, we're talking about, what, 2040s, mid-2040s, life could have moved on quite a lot on counter-detection. So I don't think it's a given the nuclear submarines will remain invulnerable forever. But they do project power because they have speed and endurance, and that's what Australia is looking for. So I understand why Australia wants to get into the business. I think that we ourselves struggling to keep up numbers of hulls, because numbers count as much as quality, that we ourselves only have nominally 7 nuclear submarines, ignoring the Triton force, just thinking of the SSN hunter-killer force for the defense of the nation, for conventional war, we only have 7. Which means that on a good day, we have 2, might be 3, and sometimes only 1, depending on various factors, at sea, which is not a lot when you think in my day, we had submarines coming out of our ears, really. I forgot what the peak number was, but it would have been...
Well, it was more than 30, more than 30 combined diesel.
That's right.
And,
yeah, so nuclear, so yeah. I and my generation think that diesel submarines could still have a role, that there are many operators. A diesel submarine can have much the same capability of a nuclear submarine, except for endurance. So it could be well placed to take the weight on fairly routine assignments of intelligence gathering, monitoring, inshore operations, shallow water, special operations, landing agents, and things like that. And it was a pity we got rid of the upholder class, but there are some very good off-the-shelf diesel submarines, particularly from Germany, which could be procured. And to add to yes, to give us numbers, because that's what we're short of. So that's a factor there. For the deterrent, in my day, I was obviously committed to the deterrent in Polaris, albeit my captain and I had agreed that we were what is called a second strike weapon, which is what we were told we were, that if we're attacked, we would respond. But we had both determined that we wouldn't deliberately fire first. That was the decision we'd made. I have been criticized for that, but we were briefed we were a second strike weapon and we had no wish to start a nuclear war. First strike implies you're working off intelligence, and I think various instances in the last 10 years, particularly Iraq, Syria, and places like that, have demonstrated the falsehood of intelligence sometimes. And who would initiate a nuclear war based on intelligence? So first strike, yes, is a no-no and should be for every nation. I then also, nobody knows totally, but you either think deterrence works or you don't. And I, on balance now, having read widely, looked at the Cold War, the analysis of it since, and various things, now know that in no stage did the Soviets intend to launch an attack on us. They were preparing themselves in case we attacked them. So we were both essentially in a second strike response mode. So what were we defending against? I think deterrence is a flawed theory, and I think perhaps Ukraine has shown the weakness of having nuclear weapons because NATO is afraid to take on Putin in case it goads him into using his own nuclear weapons. And I don't think he is necessarily beyond the first strike. I think he could be capable of doing it. But I also think he is not deterred by us having nuclear weapons from doing that. If he thought it would be to his advantage, he would do it. So there is... my biggest worry is we're investing so much in Trident that look at our conventional forces defending us against a war in Europe that could possibly engage us directly. There is no doubt about it. Our conventional forces are very poor at the moment. And I think that we would do better to be a very powerful conventional force in Europe and able to take on Putin conventionally and perhaps leave it to America to provide strategic nuclear defense if people think that's necessary. I think the UK would be better to be good at one thing rather than trying to be both.
Yeah.
And as we're going to spend over 175 billion on the Trident replacement and running it for the next 30 years, that's quite a lot of money.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I do think, having studied the wit and wisdom of Vladimir Putin through his various speeches and over the past 10, 15 years, that there is a measure of restraint, because he likes to use the phrase nuclear restraint on our friends. By that he means the West, his enemies. And I think there's a measure of restraint put on him by the thought of nuclear annihilation. Now, you're saying that the Americans would provide that, because I think Putin is definitely scared of America, definitely scared of the firepower of America and its nuclear capability, totally. I don't think he has the same fear of anybody in Europe and not the UK. But he certainly has ordered a massive investment in whether or not they work, in many wonder weapons or forthcoming wonder weapons. So it's a very complex subject. So I think there's a measure of restraint imposed on him by the nuclear capability. And yeah, I reckon it's America primarily, a little bit maybe the UK and the French, but it's a very tricky period. And I think you're right to say there are serious concerns about the lack of conventional deterrent, because if you don't have conventional deterrent, it's pretty terrible and terrifying to think that you would go straight to thinking that nuclear weapons are your first line of defense. I think that's madness, really, to think of nuclear weapons as such. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, at the moment, we are totally reliant on America to provide conventional support in Europe, because we're so weak that we would reach our nuclear tripwire too quickly, which actually then challenges whether the deterrent would be used, because we'd reach it too quickly just because we have inadequate forces. And I think America, if we said boldly, we will be a strong NATO force capable of taking on Putin conventionally, but we'll leave you to look after strategic deterrence, I think the Americans would buy that. There's good arguments for it. It is, as you say, it's a big question, and it's dangerous. I'm trying to focus my mind on what is the aim, the old submarine objective. What is the aim? The aim is to be able to stop Putin. I don't think you're going to stop him with nuclear weapons. You can only stop him with conventional weapons. We haven't got enough conventional weapons. Therefore, arguably, we're wasting money putting them into nuclear ones.
Yeah, and my worry is that whoever comes after Putin might not actually be quite as comparatively rational or calculating or sane as him. And that is a really worrying thought. And also, if Russia descends into some kind of civil war, who knows, in a few years' time, with all these factions fighting each other, then there's a massive nuclear arsenal there that is could be up for grabs. But anyway, that's probably moving beyond the remit of our chat today.
You've got a whole separate subject there.
Complex. Mm. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, it was great to have you on, Rob, and that was a good chat, and I enjoyed hearing about your career and your exploits under the sea, etc. And that was brilliant. So thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at Warships IFR, and also Twitter at Warships IFR. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.